All right. We are in Mark chapter 4, starting in verse 35, all the way through the end of chapter 5 here. And so we're going to do what we normally do. I'm going to make a couple introductory comments highlighting kind of the themes that are being drawn out in this chapter. And then we'll look at each individual section and make some comments and draw some lessons. So in these narratives, Mark is really taking Jesus' miracles to the next level. He's demonstrated Jesus has power over various diseases. He's demonstrated Jesus has power over demons, right? He's healed people. He's healed the leper. He's healed the paralytic. He's also cast out demons single, right? A couple different times so far. Kate, could you turn me down just a little bit? It's ringing just a tad up here. But in this story, Jesus' power over nature is taken to a whole nother level. He's not just doing a little healing. He's actually exercising authority over a whole storm that's threatening to sink the boat. And he's not just casting out one demon. He's casting out thousands of demons out of one person. And he's not restoring somebody who's a little bit sick with a fever. He is raising somebody back to life, reaching into death itself and pulling somebody back from the brink. And Mark is really highlighting for us a couple things. One is he's continuing with this pattern of highlighting insiders and outsiders. Who are the people who are really gods and who are not? And we'll see this in a couple different ways, but one of these is how people respond to Jesus. We see some parallels here in that the disciples respond to Jesus in fear. They say, "Who is this that even the winds and waves obey him?" And the crowds, after the demoniac is healed, they respond with fear. And they say, "Jesus, can you leave us alone, right? Don't stay in this place." And Jairus, right? Jesus says to him, "Do not fear, only believe." And so there's a pattern of fear that is tying all of these stories together. And one sort of fear is actually drawing people out to Jesus, like the disciples. They're not running away. They're simply asking, "Who is this?" Right? And it's a question that seems to be drawing them closer to Jesus. While the crowds in the Gennesaret region are saying, "Who is this?" Right? "We don't want anything to do with you." Insiders and outsiders. Okay, so let's look at Jesus calming the storm, which is the end of chapter 4. At the beginning of chapter 4, Mark begins by telling us Jesus got into a boat to teach. We saw that last time, right? There were so many crowds, he had to step off the shore and into a boat. Well, at the end of chapter 4, Jesus is in the boat and he decides to leave and go to the other side. It's evening. They start rowing across and a storm comes up. And there are two mistakes generally that people have made when interpreting this passage. Number one, some commentators have reinterpreted or said Jesus said something like, "Well, isn't this a big storm? It must be ending soon," right? So they're downplaying Jesus' authority over nature. The other mistake is to overly spiritualize this passage. We take the physical storm and make it more about the storms of life that we all go into, right? Both of those miss the point of what Mark is actually trying to tell us. This is a real physical storm that's big enough to make even fishermen who are used to being on the sea afraid for their lives, right? Mark tells us that a great wind arose, waves were breaking into the boat so that the boat was already filling. And what do we see Jesus doing here? Sleeping. Now, why does that strike us as incongruent? It's hard to sleep in a storm. Yeah. It's always loud. Yeah. You might imagine he might be getting a little wet. Right? Jesus is sleeping. It's interesting because this idea of faith and fear is the interpretive key to this chapter, right? The climax of the story is when Jesus calms the storm, and then he turns to his disciples and he says, what? What's he say? What? Yeah. Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith? Fear and faith. Jesus is actually demonstrating faith by sleeping. The Bible actually makes a really big connection between these two. Psalm 3:5 says, I lay down and slept. I awoke again, for the Lord sustained me. Psalm 4:8 says, in peace, I will both lie down and sleep. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. Psalm 127 verse 2 says, it is in vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil. For he, that is the Lord, gives to his beloved sleep. Sleep in the Bible is almost an act of faith. Being able to lay down, let our minds rest and fall asleep. And Jesus here is demonstrating that in the midst of what we would normally understand as sleepless circumstances. But he has such trust in his Father, he's not afraid. He's not afraid to the extent that he could sleep while the boat is seemingly sinking. This Mark is highlighting for us both Jesus' humanity and his divinity. He's human in that he has a human body that needs to rest. God neither sleeps nor slumbers, right? Psalm 121 tells us that. But here we see Jesus, the Son of God, who's embodied in human flesh and has been teaching all day from a boat. Now he's tired. And because he has perfect faith in his Father, he's able to lay down and sleep. Additionally, Jesus demonstrates his divinity here by exercising his authority over even the wind and the waves. Only God has the power to do this, right? Only God is able to part the seas and to make the winds to cease. Jesus here is set up both as the model of faith in God, but his power over the winds and waves sets him up as not only the model of faith, but the object of our faith. He is the one whom we should have faith in. And notice, we've already touched on this, but the disciples' response, they were afraid. Jesus here has shattered their preconceptions, right? They were starting to get an idea of who he is, right? He's the Messiah. He's doing the things that the prophet said he would do. But now he takes one step forward even beyond that. Something that they didn't expect. They're now starting to think, maybe this Messiah that was promised to us is more than we expected. Maybe he is himself the Lord God. So Jesus gets over to the other side and is confronted with an unclean spirit. The text describes him specifically in verse 3 and 4. He lived among tombs. No one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he had been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart. He broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Notice, Mark is making a parallel for us. The chaos and the uncontrolled storm is being held in parallel with the chaos of this man whom no one could subdue. And the the result of Jesus' interaction is both the storm being still and the man, the uncontrolled man, being still, sitting with him clothed and in a controlled mind. There's also a parallel in the disciples responding with fear. It's a different kind of fear, right? But also the crowds who hear about this next miracle, they also respond with fear. But it's not a fear that draws closer to Jesus, wanting to know more about who he is. It's actually a fear that causes them to shrink away and run. Jesus goes to the other side. He is encountered by this demon-possessed man. We're also told that there's lots of pigs around. Some commentators point out that because this territory was Roman-occupied and that looks like, based on some archaeology, there is a significant Roman town nearby, that pork would have been highly sought after by the Romans, which would explain why there were thousands of pigs there. One commentator brings out the significance of this. He says, if swineherds were supplying the Roman legions with pork, then the raising of unclean food for the detested Roman occupation was doubly offensive. Thus, Jesus meets a man with an unclean spirit, living among unclean tombs, surrounded by people employed in unclean occupations, all in unclean Gentile territory. Jesus is stepping in to enemy territory in more ways than one. And the question is he going to be overcome and made unclean, or is he going to be the overcomer? And Mark demonstrates for us that Jesus is the overcomer, right? He frees this man who could not be freed by any other means. So Jesus is encountered with this man who's unclean in unclean territory. The demon recognizes who Jesus is. He recognizes Jesus' authority. So far, it looks like a typical demon exorcism that Jesus does, right? This is pretty normal in the Gospels. Jesus encounters somebody. There's an unclean spirit. They cry out, recognize his authority, and then Jesus sends him away. Something different happens here in this passage. And why do you think, what do you think is the significance of this interaction? What's different about this story? The demons negotiate with Jesus? Yeah, that's different. What else? There's many demons. Yes. What else? He casts them in the pigs. Yeah, that's odd. What else? Yeah, that's different. There's significance there. He tells the man differently than he's told other people. It's interesting, Jesus actually asked the demon his name. It's significant because it hasn't happened before. And if Jesus hadn't done that, we wouldn't have known that there was more than one demon there. The demon responds, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And for the Romans, a legion would have consisted of about 5,000 men plus some cavalry and horsemen and the Praetorian Guard. And so some people think it was 5,600 soldiers of various ranks would have made up a Roman legion. The point here is not that there is necessarily 5,600 demons in this person, but that there were many. And this is not a simple Jesus casts out one demon. Jesus is casting out many demons here. And he does it just like he does stilling the storm, with a word. Jesus expends no more effort to cast out thousands of demons than he does one. He says, "Be gone," and they go. In this instance, Jesus allows them to go into the pigs. Some commentators have mixed opinions on why this is, but most of them agree. One of the reasons is as a sign that this person was truly cleansed. There weren't any leftovers. There were many demons there, and so they went into many pigs as a sign that there's kind of a one-to-one transference here. There weren't any holdouts to Jesus' authority. And the going into the many pigs and them rushing down and destroying themselves is a sign that all of the many demons were cast out. Interestingly enough, the demons who exercised control over this man can't seem to exercise control over the pigs to keep them from running down and killing themselves. Okay, so we've already pointed out some of the things that are different about this, but notice Jesus' power is highlighted here, and the response of the man is also highlighted. We have the demons who interestingly beg Jesus to be led into the pigs. We have the crowds who, when they hear of it, beg Jesus to leave. And then we have the healed man who begs Jesus to stay or to allow him to stay. This is discipleship language. And with the crowds and the demons, Jesus actually grants their requests. Isn't that interesting? This is a sign again of judgment on these people. They ask for something that is bad for them, and Jesus grants it. It reminds us of the Israelites who complain and say, "We don't have meat." And so God gives them what they ask for and makes them sick. Here, they encounter Jesus and they say, "We'd rather have the demons. We'd rather have the pigs, right? Can you just go away and leave us alone?" And Jesus grants their request. He departs and goes to another region. But he leaves somebody behind. He grants the first two requests, but he says no to the last one, to the Gentile who asks to stay, to join with him in discipleship. And Jesus says, no, go and declare all that the Lord has done for you. What the Lord has done for this man is what Jesus has done. Jesus' work here is equivalent to God's work. And this Gentile is the first Gentile missionary. He's the first Gentile sent to the Gentiles to declare what the Lord has done. And what's amazing is that even though the people asked Jesus to leave, their response immediately, their immediate response was faith that cringes back and says, "Get away." We're told later that the crowds marveled at all the things that this man had said to them. Okay, so Mark goes on. He leaves the story of the man who is oppressed by a demon, and he moves on to the story of the two daughters. And the story is interesting because it starts out with Jairus asking to come heal his little girl, his little daughter. We found out later that this girl is 12 years old, so she's not really little anymore, but she is beloved. She is his beloved daughter. And so Jesus goes and goes to Jairus' house, but he stopped on the way. He stopped by this woman who has a bleeding disease. She is ceremonially unclean because of this, and so would have experienced much of the outsiderness that we saw previously the leper would have also experienced. And she has suffered much, Mark tells us, not only from the disease and the cultural ramifications of it, but from the physicians trying to heal her. I wish we could say that wasn't true in our day. Trying to heal us too, when he tells the story, not surprisingly. But Mark tells of this woman who is an outcast, who is ashamed. We see her kind of hiding in the shadows, thinking if she could only touch Jesus, she would be healed. She wants to touch and then fade away back into the shadows. And she succeeds in touching Jesus, but she does not succeed in vanishing into the shadows. Notice how Jesus addresses her as daughter. He stopped his mission to save the little daughter to heal a different daughter, a different one of his cherished ones. One commentator says, there's a significance in the sandwich of these two daughter stories. We see someone pleading with Jesus, would you please come and heal my daughter, my little girl, the one that I love? And Jesus, in the middle of the passage, gets interrupted and takes the time to say, hey, I've got to stop for a moment and heal my daughter. The woman is his. He sees her. He wants her to know and wants everyone else to know that she is his daughter. Faith from this woman brings more than the gift of healing. It brings the gift of identity. Jesus calls the paralyzed man his son. He now calls this woman his daughter. Salvation says more than you are not guilty, you can go free. It says you are family, you can stay. If you're a Christian, you are a son or daughter of the King. This woman's story is part of a much bigger story, right? Ever since sin came into the world, we've been looking for healing, for cleansing, for someone to take away the shame and bring us back into God's presence. And here is Jesus himself doing that. One of the things that we've been seeing is Jesus and his authority, right? He comes with power. He stills the storm. He casts out demons. But he also has time to stop and pay attention to the daughters, right? He stops for the little ones who need cleansing. He clothes and heals the demoniac and sits with him. At the end of our section, when he raises up the daughter who's died, he stops and says, give her something to eat, right? The family's amazed that God, Jesus, has raised up the daughter, and they could be overcome by that and forget she's been sick for a while. She probably hasn't eaten. Jesus, the Almighty God of the universe, sees the details of the story and pays attention and shows care. He's not a coming king who rules with an iron fist and lords it over his people. He comes as the Savior, the one who's got the big picture, but also takes care of the little details. Okay, there's a couple other things that are of interest here as Jesus continues. He pauses to deal with this one woman, and in the midst of the pause, right, the little girl, Jairus' daughter, appears to die. She dies. And Jesus says to Jairus, what? What's he say? Do not fear, only believe. You see the theme here? Then he goes, and his power over death is not displayed in a grand ritual or an explosion of supernatural power, but in a word. And he tells her to get up. She takes her hand, says, little girl, arise. It's what you might say to your own kids when you go to wake them up for school in the morning. Hey, guys, it's time to get up for school, right? This is what the original language is communicating is Jesus here. He's coming and saying, hey, little girl, it's time to get up. And in doing so, he reaches down into death itself and grabs back this little child. So Jesus demonstrates not just power over death, but care for us. And by, again, reminding these parents that they need to give this little girl some food. Okay, I know there are lots of questions from your time in group together, and so there's more that we could say about these stories that would be beneficial, but I'm going to finish here and answer any questions that came up in your groups this week. Yes?
How story we just had, it's asking us about some of the mourners would have been professionals brought in for the funeral.
Yeah.
Culturally, what was that back then? I didn't understand that.
Sure. So what were the mourners doing, right? The extra resources say that they may have had some professional mourners. And so I actually encountered this when I was over in Uganda. Somebody, a family member, had passed away. And in the ancient days, you didn't go to a mortuary and get cleaned up and presented for death and pumped full of chemicals so that your body wouldn't decompose and you could have a funeral a week later or 2 weeks later or however it was, right? As soon as you die, your body starts composing and you've got a ticking time clock on when it's appropriate for burial. And so there are mourners who are there, part of the family, but there would have also been people who would have been occasionally brought in to mourn with them. The more people you have mourning is a sign of the importance or significance of that person or the significance of their family. And so you might have had not just the family mourning, but professional mourners who would come in and kind of fluff the mourning pot, so to speak, right? Make it into a big deal and as a sign of how important this particular person was to the family or to the culture, right? You would expect the mayor or one of the town elders to have more mourners than the town drunk, right? And so you would have these professional mourners who would weep and make loud noises and throw dust and ashes and things like this to as part of the mourning ceremony. Okay, what else? Does that answer the question? Yes, back here. I don't know that there's a ton of significance in that. I didn't see any of the commentators draw special mention of that. So, yeah. If anything, it's a sign that Mark is giving us real life events, right? His recounting of things is specific enough to affirm that these were historical events that really happened and not just general stories that you might find in Aesop's fables. What else? Yes. Yeah, great question. What happened to the demons once they went into the water? The text doesn't tell us. And there are two mistakes we can make here. One is, there are two, let me clarify this. There are two mistakes we can make when it comes to thinking about demons and spiritual warfare in general. One is, we can pretend that that doesn't exist, right? The scriptures are clear. The devil is prowling about like a roaring lion seeking those whom he may destroy. Spiritual warfare is a real thing, and we're called to be on guard and to recognize we're not fighting against flesh and blood, but against something deeper and darker. The other side, the other mistake we can make, is we can become infatuated with demons and the demonic, angels, angelology, and it can distract us from the point of the story, right? We can get caught up into speculation that can actually lead to fear, right? We can, I'm not saying anybody's doing this, but we can do things like, well, if the demons could go into pigs, what else can they go in, right? Can they go into horses? Can they get in my dog? What about the pork that I just ate? Did I just eat a demon-possessed taco? And we can start seeing demons under every bush and in every hole, and it actually distracts us from Jesus, right? The point of the text is do not fear, only believe. Jesus is the strong man who comes to set captives free, whether it's a captive of one demon or captive of 5,000 demons. Jesus speaks and they go. So the point of the story and what ought to capture our attention is the magnificence and the authority of Jesus. What happened to the demons? You know, we can speculate about that, but the scriptures aren't clear, and speculation is probably not going to lead us anywhere helpful. It reminds me, actually, of what Paul warns Timothy of when he says, don't get caught up in myths about genealogies and ceremonies, right? Those things aren't helpful. They distract. They lead to dissensions. They keep us from doing the main thing that God has called us to do, which is to move forward with faith and with power and proclaim all that he has done, just like the Gentile demoniac who was delivered. Yes.
Says that the pigs
yes.
So wouldn't that indicate that Jesus completely destroyed the demons because the pigs drowned?
Yeah, the pigs did drown, and we could, since the demons said they didn't want to be sent out into the wasteland but wanted to go into the pigs, right? We might be able to draw something from that, but again, it's not super significant for Mark's main point, which is do not fear, believe.
Do we know for sure that he is a Gentile? Is it just assumed because it was a Gentile area?
Yeah, I think it's mostly assumed because it is a Gentile area and you wouldn't have found many Jews there. It's also significant that he is sent back to proclaim the news to the Gentiles. That would not have been as well received coming from a Jew. And so it seems to make the most sense if he's a Gentile.
So he was out in the tombs because of his uncontrolled behavior.
Yeah. Right. Yes. And again, Jesus accepting a Gentile as one of his disciples would have hindered his ministry specifically to the Jews, right? He came first to Israel. And so that's one of the main reasons that commentators say Jesus didn't allow this particular disciple to join with him, but to actually be sent to other Gentiles. Any final questions? Yes, back here. Yeah.
It's not really a question, it's just an observation.
No. Yeah. So, the other boats pass the other boats section. Mark's actually the only one who notes this in this particular story. And so, some commentators say, and I think I agree with this, is that this is another example of Jesus demonstrating care, not just for his disciples, but for people generally. Right? If the disciples' boat was sinking, it's likely that many of those other boats were sinking as well. It reminds a little bit of the final words of God to Jonah when he's talking about Nineveh, where he says, don't you have compassion for these 50 or 40 or however many thousand souls that live in this city and also much cattle? Right? There's this general idea that the Lord cares for the welfare of everyone. And we see that in the other boats passage and then with the woman who's trying to dart back into the shadows but is brought forward and called daughter in front of everyone. And then even at the end where he says, hey, give her something to eat, right? It's Jesus' attention and compassion for the details of our lives and the well-being of people generally. All right, that's all we have time for today. If you've got more questions, feel free to let me know. And otherwise, I will see you guys next week.